Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you the latest news from across Ukraine, and we speak to Dr. Sasha Dovzhik about the concept of ecocide and the harm done to Ukraine's environment during the full-scale invasion.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Thursday, the 28th of March, 2 years and 33 days since the full-scale invasion began. Today, I'm joined by our associate editor, Dominic Nichols, and our guest is Dr. Sasha Dovzhik, editor of the London Ukrainian Review. I started by asking Dom for the latest updates from Ukraine.
Well, hi, David. Hi, everybody. Welcome, Sasha. Okay, quite a lot today because I'll be doing France's bits as well. So let's dive straight in. Missile strikes on Kharkiv hit a five-story apartment building and a playground in the northwestern part of the city. That comes from local media. That happened over the last day. Deaths have been reported there. A 12-year-old boy was also killed after shelling in the town of Borova in the Kharkiv Oblast, but about 100 k's southeast of Kharkiv. Now, it's thought that might be a new type of guided bomb that was used against Kharkiv. It's being dubbed the UMPB-D30. That came from local officials. They say it's something between a guided aerial bomb, which the Russians have used recently, and a missile. That was Police Chief Vladimir Timoshenko. And then Oleh Sibunov, the regional governor, said it seems the Russians decided to test their modified bombs on the residents of the houses. Now, just a very brief segue, if I may. It's worth having a look at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, IISS. They put out a new paper on Monday of this week looking at this new glide bomb. They say images of what's been called the Universal Interspecific Gliding Munition, albeit abbreviated to UMPB. They said images were first circulated on social media earlier this month, and there are suggestions that these new glide bombs can be ground-launched from MLRS, multiple launch rocket systems, as well as air-launched. Russia seems to be using glide bombs along with direct attack munitions in volume to overwhelm Ukraine's air defence, although it's been nothing like the attacks of last week. So IISS just to get us all up to speed, they say at the outset of the full-scale invasion, Ukrainian ground-based air defence relied very heavily on the S-300, known in NATO as the SA-10 Grumble. They were used for long-range engagement, and Ukraine also used the Buk, the SA-11 Gadfly, for medium-range targets. By February of last year, they say the US was very concerned that the rate of use of air defence meant that Kyiv would run out of both of those types by May 2023. As they said, up to 180 S-300s were being fired every month. That was the point at which the US undertook the project dubbed Franken-SAM. We've talked about it before. But this was the efforts to integrate the Raytheon Sea Sparrow missile onto the Buk launcher and also the Brits. We modified the MBDA, that's the company, the Advanced Short Range Air-to-Air Missile, the ASRAM, as it's known, modified that for ground launch using Supercat's HMT 600 vehicle. That was used by the British Army in Afghanistan. It was called the Coyote, one of the four or was it five different vehicle variants called the Dogs of War. But the Coyote firing ASRAM is also one of these kind of Frank-and-Sam thingies. Now, the Ukraine's S-300s, for the most part, have been replaced by US Patriots, the PAC-3 variant, the most modern variant. And they've also, there are suggestions that Ukraine's been getting S-300s from Greece, although they've not confirmed that. We know they're getting IRIS-T and NASAMS, National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile Systems. Those are both short and medium-range systems. So that's the kind of family that they've got at the moment. Speaking of the strikes last night, President Zelensky dubbed them as Russian terror and repeated his calls for more air defence for Ukraine. Now then, down south in the Kherson region, one man was killed, another left in critical condition after a mine explosion. This was in the village of Chervony Mayak. That's on the banks of the Dnipro River, but about 50 k's upstream from Kherson city. One man died at the scene. The other chap had severe injuries, lost both legs. A snapshot, a bit graphic, I apologise for that, but a snapshot of, you know, normality. If you think about how horrific that was, that's happening every day. Now, nearly a third of Ukraine's total landmass has been mined since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion. More than 270 Ukrainians, including 14 kids, have been killed by mines and other exploding ordnance since then. Now, also last night, Ukrainian forces shot down 26 of 28 Shahed drones, fired basically east, south and southeast Ukraine. That came from the Air Force. There were injuries in Zaporizhia and Kharkiv. And then in Odessa, Russia carried out a series of missile strikes later yesterday morning, but no injuries reported. That comes from Olekhipa, who's the regional governor there. Now then, outside of Ukraine, and Putin's foreign intelligence chief has paid a visit to North Korea this week. Yet more signs of a deepening relationship between Moscow and Pyongyang. So this is Sergei Naryshkin, the head of the SVR, Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service. He was in the North Korean capital on, well, Monday to Wednesday this week. This is a statement from the SVR. Apparently he met his counterpart while he was over there. So TASS, the Russian state-owned news agency, reported the meetings. They quoted loads of words about security, pressure from external forces, foreign plots. But believe me, you don't need to put any effort into thinking about them. Clearly the Kremlin and North Korea didn't put any effort into coming up with the statements when they made them. Anyway, next one, an update on the Moscow attack, the attack at the Crocus City Hall last Friday. Kirill Budanov, Ukraine's military intelligence chief, he says that Russia was aware of preparations for a terrorist attack at least since February the 15th. He said Moscow knew specific details about the group behind the attack on the concert hall, which at the moment, I think it's up to 130 people dead. He said he was at an event in Kyiv, Mr. Budanov, General Budanov. He said this information was passed through the group's intelligence agency in Syria. From there, it was passed on to Moscow. Don't let them tell you it miraculously appeared out of nowhere. Now, he also claimed Russian authorities may have allowed the attack to go ahead in order to trigger an internal power struggle aimed at removing some high-ranking officials. I simply don't know, to be honest. He said, another option is that they actually underestimated the scale of what would happen. They thought it would be more local. They wanted to blame Ukraine for everything. I mean, as I said, I've no idea, absolutely no idea about that. I can't really comment. I just report it. But as a reminder, on March the 8th, the US issued a warning amplified by the British embassy. They warned that, quote, extremists have imminent plans to target large gatherings in Moscow to include concerts. It was pretty clear at the time. Now then, the next one. Some good news from Putin. He said Russia will not attack NATO, but F-16 fighter jets supplied to Ukraine will be shot down. He said, we have no aggressive intentions towards these states. He was speaking to a group of Russian Air Force pilots visiting a combat training centre. He said, the idea that we will attack some other country, Poland, the Baltic states, the Czechs are also being scared, is complete nonsense. It's just drivel. He did, though, say that F-16 aircraft supplied to Ukraine, if they took off from third countries, would be legitimate targets. He said, if they're used from airfields in third countries, they become for a legitimate target. Well, I've just said that. Right. Now then, I think, I don't believe a word the bloke says. It's good that he says the idea that we will attack some other countries just drivel. That's if you ignore Russia's nerve agent attack in the UK in 2006, the attack on Georgia in 2008, the attack on Syria in 2015. Does that count? He did it for his mate. I don't know if that one counts. Another nerve agent attack in the UK in 2018 and Ukraine 22. But no, Vladimir, it's all nonsense. And then just to finally, three from Poland, if I may, David. Reaching a breakthrough on the grain deal with Ukraine is unlikely, a Polish official has warned. Kyiv officials have gone to Warsaw for talks to try and defuse the ongoing hostilities over the grain issue. So speaking to the Polish state news agency, Jan Grabiak, who's the head of the Polish the Prime Minister's office, said it is difficult to expect any breakthrough after these talks, any specific agreement, for example, on agricultural issues. We are still in dialogue and both sides, at least for today, are not fully satisfied. Now, his comments come, you'll remember, amid a wave of protests. Angry Polish farmers blocked the border with Ukraine to voice their opposition to EU agriculture policy, which they say undercuts them by allowing cheap grain imports from Kyiv. There are credible suggestions and reports that some of those protests have had participation from pro-Kremlin agitators, though. Now, sticking in Poland, and quite a remarkable statement this morning from the Ministry of National Defence there. The Military Counterintelligence Service has initiated inspection proceedings regarding the personal security clearance of Lieutenant General Yaroslav Gromadzinski. A decision was made to dismiss Lieutenant General Gromadzinski from his position as Eurocorps commander and his immediate return to the country. Now, Eurocorps is a joint military group of some EU and NATO states. It started, gosh, when did it start? 20-odd years ago, as a sort of Franco-German corps. It grew from there. It's based in Strasbourg. It gets involved in sort of EU training missions. They've been involved in Mali and the Central African Republic. Eurocorps has also been involved in NATO missions, Bosnia, Kosovo, and they had individuals embedded in the Kabul HQ during the Afghanistan years. Now, Viktor Kovalenko, who's a Russia-Ukraine analyst, he said that General Gromadzinski has been removed after a counterintelligence investigation found proof that he was working for Russia. This guy apparently is responsible for NATO military supplies to Ukraine. So, that I mean, the fact that you're removing from post the commander of Eurocorps is very significant. If there are suggestions tying him to Russia, especially if it's anything to do with military supplies to Ukraine, that would be very serious. So very much keeping an eye on that. And then finally, David, Poland, the International Armoured Vehicle Coalition for Ukraine has met for the first time today in Warsaw. This was a coalition formed by Poland and Germany a few weeks ago, supported by the Brits, Swedes and the Italians. Quite what's going to come out of it, we shall see. And that's us up to date, David.
Well, thank you very much, Dom Nichols, for all of those updates. It's a great pleasure to welcome to Ukraine the Latest Dr. Sasha Dovzhik. Sasha's obviously spoken to us a few times before, but it's a great pleasure to have you in the studio in London. Sasha, for those of our listeners who may need reminding, can you just introduce yourself and your work again to them?
Hello, David. I'm very pleased to be here and very pleased to be in the London studio of The Telegraph. Thank you so much for having me.
A pleasure. Can you tell us first, why have you come to London? Tell us a little bit about the event tonight and what you'll be talking about.
So tonight at the RSA, the Royal Society for the Encouragement of the Arts, we'll have an event run by the Ukrainian Institute London with partners focused on global environmental challenges, lessons from Ukraine. It seems that there can hardly be an issue that is more literally crossing borders than environment. In Ukraine, we do suffer from environmental damage brought by Russian war, but it's not only inside Ukrainian borders that we will feel the consequences. And it's a great opportunity for us to discuss these issues with a panel of brilliant experts from the Flanders, Finland, the UK, and of course from Ukraine.
Nature is a key witness, victim, and weapon of modern military conflicts. Can you explain that for our listeners and tell us how that's playing out in Ukraine?
Sure, thank you. I think I will start with nature as victim because this is quite obvious when we talk about environmental damage. Obviously, wars unfold in natural environments, and it's not only people who suffer from war damage, but also the environment. When traveling in Ukraine to the northern regions, to the eastern regions, I can see it with my own eyes while passing by forests that are damaged by artillery artillery shells and actually thinking about those forests becoming unreachable for us for quite a few decades because of the mines planted there by the Russian invasion, the damage becomes very literal. It becomes even more literal when we think about what Russian destruction of dams, for example, brings to the Ukrainian environment. We may well remember the destruction of the Kakhovka Dam in June 2023, which resulted in a flooding of, I think, 80 settlements in southern Ukraine. This was not only felt by humans, we think that 16,000 people were affected by the flooding, but also by ecosystems in southern Ukraine. The masses of water that became toxic through through industrial waste, through washing, through refineries and agricultural lands, they brought all these toxins into the river basin and into the basin of the Black Sea. Some fish species that are endangered and that are specific and they only are present in that particular area of Ukraine became extinct as a result of this violent act of destruction. Our response as an international community to this violence has not been sufficient to deter further acts like this. And we may remember that it was only last week that Russians targeted another dam in Ukraine in Zaporizhia, which is Dniprohess, the largest hydroelectric power plant and the largest dam in the country. Zaporizhia happens to be my home region, and the blast shattered windows in our flat, which is just two blocks away. So again, environmental damage and human damage overlap in these kinds of scenarios. Speaking about nature as a weapon, we again can think about all this damage brought by the flooding result of Russian destruction of the dams. We may remember that in the summer, the flooding caused by the destruction of the Kakhovka Dam was actually one of the factors that slowed down the advance of the Ukrainian army in the south. So here, nature plays a key role in the military scenarios and the military developments in Ukraine. And thinking about nature as a witness, I remember the experience of the Ukrainian poet Katerina Mikhalitsyna, who told me about coming to the site of a recent Russian strike in Lviv, again in the summer of 2023. So at night, this city far removed from the front lines, it's in the very west of the country. At night on the 7th of July, if I'm not mistaken, it was targeted by Russian missiles. And in the morning, Katerina came to the site to see if she could be of help. What she witnessed there were trees around the blast site that were stark naked. So the blast wave just tore away all their leaves. And they obviously, the trees are not the main victims because people died in that strike, but they were also affected, and it brought to her the gravity of our responsibility as humans involved in these military conflicts in front of the environment and our natural surroundings and ecosystems that sustain us and that are defenseless against all these actions.
Sasha, thank you very much for that overview. Could you tell us a little bit more about your travels internally in Ukraine? Obviously, as listeners will know, it's, you know, the largest country in Europe. There are a number of different ecosystems, a number of different climates even. Tell us a little bit more about where you've traveled and what you've seen. I mean, you've spoken about Zaporizhia and Chernihiv, but where else?
The most recent journey, a volunteer trip with PEN Ukraine. It's an organization of writers and human rights activists who brought books and humanitarian aid to the northern region of Chernihiv. It took place just a week and a half ago, so my memories from it are quite fresh. The northern region is famous for its forests, and while you travel north, you pass by absolutely beautiful Ukrainian woods and Ukrainian forests that are now heavily damaged by the fighting. And again, it brings to mind this idea that it's not only humans who suffer from military conflicts, but also these silent bystanders, the trees and forests of northern Ukraine. I'm also thinking about the eastern region, Kharkiv and Donetsk regions that were deoccupied in 2022 by the Ukrainian armed forces. And there, as our listeners may know, the landmines were planted throughout the area. They were actually dispersed from airplanes. And it means that these quite light anti-personnel landmines can be planted basically wherever. Wherever there is high grass, you're advised not to leave paths because just stepping beyond them would mean risking your life or your limb. It's quite eerie to be in those places, and when you leave them, you have this anxiety about stepping on a lawn for a very long time. It's planted deep in your body once you leave those areas, and these consequences are something that will for a long time define Ukrainian lifestyles for our and future generations. Here I'm thinking also of the concept of a Ukrainian researcher, Svetlana Matviyenko, who writes in the recent issue of the London Ukrainian Review about vertical occupation. Usually when we think about occupation, we imagine the deep state map and the horizontal movement of lines, troops, and colors on that map. But what Svetlana Matviyenko discusses is this vertical level, the poisoning of our groundwaters, the poisoning of our ecosystems, the poisoning of our air that is longstanding and will stay with us for quite a long time, unfortunately.
I can relate a little bit, Sasha, to your experience in the East. When I went down to Kramatorsk last summer, we went down several roads where we were told, watch out, don't leave the asphalt. Both fields and both of these sides are mined. And it is, I agree, it's completely eerie, because unless there's a sign, unless you're told it, you actually don't know. And then suddenly your entire mind is just thinking, right, just make sure your foot never leaves the road. And you suddenly get a sense of, I mean, even if you think of it like just in terms of sheer space, the road is actually not that much space. It's quite narrow, and everything else on both sides you just simply cannot go to. So I completely see what you mean there. One term that is being used by some is ecocide. We've spoken earlier this week about genocide and about what genocide is, how we might define it, how we can apply the word, understand it, and think about it legally and analytically. Could you tell us about ecocide and the current campaign to make it a more formal a legal ruling?
It's one of the urgent issues on our mind. As you well know, some of the grave crimes in the International Criminal Court have entered this criminal court, the legislature, through experiences of Ukraine, of the population that inhabited the territory of Ukraine in the 20th century. And here we can think about genocide, and here we can think about crimes against humanity. As we know very well, Holocaust in large part played out on the territory of contemporary Ukraine. Ecocide is something that we hope to introduce into the International Criminal Court as the fifth international crime. In 2021, there was a gathering of the independent expert panel convened by Stop Ecocide Foundation, and its CEO, Giorgio Metta, will be tonight with us at the RSA, so I encourage our listeners to also tune into that discussion. This expert panel managed to come up with a legal definition of ecocide. And if you don't mind, I will read it out in order not to make mistakes. So ecocide means unlawful or wanton acts committed with knowledge that there is a substantial likelihood of severe and either widespread or long-term damage to the environment being caused by those acts. I had a privilege of sitting at an interview with Giorgio Metta conducted by Anna Ackerman for the London Ukrainian Review, where they discussed how this concept became solidified in the course of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The criminal acts committed by the Russian army in Ukraine, such as the destruction of the Kakhovka Dam, may well become a legal precedent for setting ecocide as this fifth international criminal offense. When we think about the criminal code, we often imagine a robber or someone running through a dark street with a knife at night. But actually, when we introduce something into the criminal statute, it means that we are thinking about protection. And here we are thinking about the protection of nature and of about the protection of our environments in the context of armed conflicts and otherwise. And these precedents set in Ukraine these days may well serve the protection of nature worldwide. And we definitely hope that that will be the case.
Sasha, you've spoken at length about the damage inflicted and the time needed for the land to recover from the war and from occupation. Do you have any stories of regeneration and recovery you'd like to share as well?
There is actually one exciting story of regeneration and quite a surprising one. I keep returning to the Kakhovka Dam today, but it's another story related to that incident. So in the aftermath of this catastrophe, when Ukrainian environmentalists were able to assess this site, they discovered that just in a few months after the Kakhovka reservoir was depleted, its bottom became covered with trees, and those trees were as high as 2.5 meters. So now where this Kakhovka Sea used to be, there is a forest, and it is a sign of hope for us, and it is a sign that nature, if left alone by us, can actually recover and regenerate. Let's cross our fingers for that.
One of the things you're talking about tonight is ideas of what other parts of the world can learn from Ukraine as it pioneers, as you've spoken about, the idea of bringing ecocide into a discussion about justice. What do you think people around the world could learn from these discussions?
Thank you for this question. I think I will be repeating something that you at Ukraine the Latest often discuss. One of the lessons that we in Ukraine keep learning and keep repeating that the world should learn from us is that impunity encourages further evil acts. So Russian impunity for the Kakhovka Dam destruction and the lack of international response to that criminal act has meant that Russia felt at ease hitting again the largest dam in Ukraine in Zaporizhia last week. We can think here again about the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which was occupied by Russians in early March 2022. What have we as an international community done to respond to it, to demilitarize this zone? When Russians hit Zaporizhia region last week with missiles, the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant was again at a risk of a blackout because it was cut off the electric grid. If we keep encouraging criminal acts for not holding Russia accountable, these criminal acts will only escalate. And it's not only Ukrainians who will pay the price, but the world at large, I'm afraid. There is, again, nothing as literal as environment that we as humans share throughout the world. The water that is poisoned in Ukraine will end up somewhere in Europe. We should think about it when we allow Russia to persist in the destruction of nature in Ukraine.
Looking in slightly more detail at the question of mines, we've spoken a lot about how much of Ukraine has been mined by Russia. What's the conversation in Ukraine about the assessment of the time it will take to demine? I mean, what can you tell us about that? How do these conversations go? I mean, you mentioned earlier about the idea that entire generations of people won't be able to enjoy and visit the forests where they live.
Yes, indeed. The territory of Ukraine that is currently mined, I was shocked when I tried to calculate it and found out that it's approximately the size of Austria and Hungary combined. So you can imagine the extent of this devastation. Currently, we speak about decades that it would take to demine the territory. The latest number that I heard was 70 years. I think it might be optimistic, but to bring in some optimism, we also should not disregard technological progress and hope that in the future there will be a technical solution that would allow Ukrainians to demine their territory faster.
And looking at the Kharkovka Dam, you've mentioned this incident a few times today because it plays such a prominent role in discussions of ecocide and environmental crimes. Are assessments of the impact of its destruction ongoing? Do we look back at the last year and we understand what the destruction of the dam meant for the environment? Or are we still learning things about how it's changing the environment around it?
We definitely still are learning things about what's happening there. And it's not simplified by the fact that it's the site of active hostilities. So my colleagues from Pan-Ukraine travel to Kherson quite regularly. And every time they do that, I'm conscious that they put their lives on the line. They put their lives at risk. There is constant shelling there. And it means that any scientific research cannot be conducted in safety. So the most evident thing that we can do to progress in that area is to demilitarize it by pushing Russians away from the Kherson region. Then we will be able to assess what happened there last summer and what would be our path forward.
Sasha, thank you so much for your time today. Is there anything we haven't spoken about that you think is important for our listeners to hear and understand?
There is one thing that I hope you will allow me to indulge in, and it's a poem written by Katerina Mikhailitsyna when she came to that site of a Russian strike in Lviv and saw those trees. And it rhymes really with what we have been discussing here, the question of justice and the question of witnessing by nature. And if you don't mind, I would read it now.
Please.
So the poem is called Witnesses of War Crimes. It's published in the London Ukrainian Review alongside another poem by Katerina about the Kharkovka Dam. And it goes like this. In this land, even trees bear witness. Please hug me gently, asks the ash tree on the side of the road. Now even gentleness hurts. Wounds ache for a long time like fallen nuts, green as July in which an abyss yawned. And you can't bridge it, whispers the walnut tree, stark naked. I am deaf, says the acacia. It stands on tiptoe, motionless, watching for swifts. It sees them but cannot hear. I have third-degree burns, moans the fir tree. The world around me breathes heat, like the fiery maw of the dragon that devours me. And I'm too unscathed among you. Why? Says the dogwood tree softly, drooping its leaves, inwardly withered by survivor's guilt. The dust swirls up. It shrouds the salt of their testimony in the billows of silence. Who will listen to these trees? Who will call them as witnesses in court?
Coming up, we hear Dom and Sasha's final thoughts.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's move to our final thoughts then. Dom Nichols, would you like to go first?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, David. So continuing the discussion that we've been having recently about fortifications in Ukraine. There's an interesting article today in the Financial Times from Christopher Miller, who's in Chernihiv, and Stephen Bernard, talking about the work that is ongoing. And they note that President Zelensky was in the Sumy region yesterday visiting some trenches that do, and the images of those, unsurprising, I guess, because that's where the president is, they are well constructed. But whether that's going for the rest of them, we don't know. But they were quoting Valentin Badrak, who's the director of the Kyiv-based Army Conversion and Disarmament Research Center, who said that Ukraine's military leadership has displayed what he describes as a certain euphoria and believed that Western support would never stop, allowing them to keep pressing ahead. So they just didn't prioritize the construction of fortifications. They thought it was not going to be necessary. So the article does note that a new working group with Ukraine's defense ministry is coordinating the construction of this line about 2,000 kilometers. The second and third line, so the first line has been done by military units. The second and third line, slightly further back from the front, they're carried out by the State Agency for Reconstruction and Infrastructure Development with the help of private contractors. Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal said that more than 30 billion hryvnia, that's about $800 million, has been allocated to building fortifications this year. So it's, again, it sounds good. It's all going in the right direction. I think we just need to keep this conversation live and ongoing so that these efforts don't stop. I think that link between the private sector and the military is absolutely critical for second and third line, because they should be out of the immediate contact zone. The first-person view drones that Russia is flying probably won't be able to see them. They either won't get that far because the radio signal won't make it that far, or they'll be shot down on the way. So those second and third lines should be able to be constructed in an area or in an environment of relative security. So yeah, I think we just need to keep the pressure on here. It seems to be gaining the attention it deserves, albeit somewhat late. But yeah, do go and have a look at the FT report, and let's keep chatting about it. Thanks, David.
Thanks very much, Dom. Sasha, as our guest, would you like the very final words?
I was saying that I would allow myself some drama at the very end. When I was editing pieces for the London Ukrainian Review by Ukrainian authors, Katerina Mikhalitsyna, Svetlana Matveyenko, and Katerina Yakovlenko, there was a feeling that they were saying goodbye. They were still fighting. They're still fighting. They do whatever they can to advance Ukrainian victory. But the devastation that we experience as a community inside Ukraine these days is quite overwhelming. And considering the lack of international military support for Ukraine, the extent of losses at the front lines, including the losses of our friends who are fighting, they are clearing the lens for us. We know very well what is at stake. And their pieces were like these final alarm bells for me, directed at the outside world, asking the outside world to wake up to these shared threats, the threat that we all share, but Ukrainians who are just happen to be situated at the very edge, facing this black hole that is Russian fascism and imperialism, they might be seeing it just a bit more clearly. So I would encourage our listeners to stay with Ukraine, to keep up their support. And I would thank Ukraine the latest for doing that so persistently for so long. It means a lot for us, your solidarity. Thank you.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/Ukraine the Latest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our world affairs newsletter which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And, if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Giles Gear, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.